Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Greg Schneider, Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, on the newly released report on knowledge of the Holocaust in France. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It's Super Bowl Sunday today, a contemporary American holiday that's surpassed most of the others on our calendar in regular observance. Certainly, more people celebrate Super Bowl Sunday in America by having a party to watch the game, drink beer, and overeat than actively celebrate, oh, say, President's Day or Labor Day or observe Martin Luther King Day or Memorial Day. Super Bowl Sunday is, in all likelihood, the third most observed American festive day after Thanksgiving and possibly the 4th of July, slightly ahead of Christmas and Valentine's Day, which have limitations on their popularity. There are lots of Christians in the U.S., but the current figure is just 65%, so not everybody celebrates Christmas. And Valentine's Day doesn't really work if you don't have a date or are too young or too wise to care about a holiday invented by greeting card and candy companies, the Amalgamated Union of Florists, jewelry cartels, and the restaurateurs of America. So Super Bowl Sunday is a big holiday in its own highly commercialized way. Might surprise you to know this, but there have been significant Jewish angles on the last couple of Super Bowls, and there is one this time as well. 2 years ago, both owners, Jeffrey Lurie of the winning Philadelphia Eagles and Robert Kraft of the losing New England Patriots, were Jewish, as was Eagles general manager Howie Roseman. Actually, 9 out of 32 NFL owners today are Jewish. Wow. Last year, the Patriots, still owned by Robert Kraft, who received the Jewish Genesis Prize last summer, won the game, and Julian Edelman, the Patriots wide receiver, became the first Jewish Super Bowl MVP to win the award when the Patriots defeated the LA Rams. Another Jewish player on the Patriots, Nate Ebner, saw action. And the stadiums for both of the past two Super Bowls were owned or operated by Jews, Ziggy Wilf in Minnesota and Arthur Blank in Atlanta, the owners of the Vikings and Falcons, respectively. So, who or what's the Jewish connection this year? Is there one? Of course there's one. This year, it's All-Pro offensive tackle Mitchell Schwartz of the Kansas City Chiefs, a star lineman who was bar mitzvahed at Temple Adat Shalom in West Los Angeles and wasn't permitted by his parents to play organized football until he had completed his bar mitzvah studies. He and his older brother Jeff were the first Jewish brothers to play on the same NFL field on opposing teams in over 80 years. And together with an author, they wrote a light, funny book 3 years ago called Eat My Schwartz, Our Story of NFL Football, Food, Family, and Faith. So, yes, Virginia, Jews do play NFL football and even can star in the Super Bowl, which means that you should serve something kosher today along with your other treats this Super Bowl in honor of the Jewish connection to this very American festival. To play us in on this August morning, here's past two Jewish guest Matisyahu's Ode to Unity and Blessing. It's called One Day.
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday. I've been praying for the people to say.
That was Matisyahu singing One Day for, I guess, Super Bowl Sunday today with its Jewish connection. Our guest this morning, Greg Schneider, is the executive director of the Conference on Material Claims Against Germany, better known as the Claims Conference. They commissioned a study on knowledge of the Holocaust in France this last year, and the results just released are startling. Hear about them when we return in a moment. On to Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, brand new adult classes, kids classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives daily to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, including brand new introductory Judaism and Talmud classes beginning today, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha has moved into new, larger quarters in our synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, Suite 100, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla. Tot Kabbalat Shabbat services for very young children and their parents and grandparents are at 5:30 p.m., while our Shabbat evening celebration services follow at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but in our own building on the south side. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, great music and rich array of adult education academy courses, some starting right now in February, and of course all of our many services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, that's BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing and newest Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Greg Schneider, the executive director of the Claims Conference, which has worked for... wow, many years to establish justice for Holocaust survivors and to educate the world on the Shoah. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
There's a new report on anti-Semitism in France, and maybe you can give us a little bit of a background on that.
We recently did a survey about Holocaust knowledge and awareness in France. So we were looking at what people knew about the Holocaust. Did they understand the context, what it meant for humanity, the Jewish people, and attitudes around the questions about the Holocaust?
And, of course, I have to ask, and the results were?
Well, there were two main results. One, shocking and appalling lack of knowledge about the Holocaust. But the good news, that overwhelmingly people feel that Holocaust should be taught in schools, that it's important, and that people should know about the Holocaust.
So a little bit of good news, but how has France addressed the question of education about the Shoah? I don't know how many of our listeners realize, but in some countries, Germany has been a notable example. They've worked very hard to teach people about the Holocaust. America is kind of middling on that. How has France fallen in recent years?
So there was a perception that France has been doing well because Holocaust education is mandated, it's required in French schools. But the results of the survey show that a mandate is not sufficient, that much, much, much more work needs to be done. And we really need to be talking about the quality of the education, and particularly teacher training, that the teachers in the classrooms have the resources and have the skills to properly handle a pretty complicated topic.
And is the funding adequate? I mean, you kind of come to that often, don't you?
Yes. Definitely not. Absolutely not. France is a big country, a lot of high school kids, and a lot of teachers. You know, the complication of teaching in a country like France is this is where the Holocaust happened. And so you're also confronting, grappling with issues of what grandparents were doing during the war. Were they complicit? Were they perpetrators? Were they victims? Were they bystanders? Those are emotional, complicated issues, and they have to be dealt with. And so in the context of teaching about World War II, spending an hour talking about the Holocaust is really not sufficient.
We will talk much more with Greg Schneider, head of the Claims Conference, about Holocaust education in France and what can be done about it when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about security and insecurity in the American Jewish community and the incredible and distressing rise of violent anti-Semitism over the last few years, particularly the last year and a half even. There's a lot of different ways of approaching the problem. One of them is to become more like European synagogues with layers of defense basically around every Jewish institution, and some of that's already taking place. But that's not the solution, not in the long term. It's just a way of preventing terrible attacks sometimes.
Yeah, that only addresses incidents of violent anti-Semitism and not what causes the sentiment of violent anti-Semitism.
Right. So, or this dramatic rise.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it might be helpful to look at some of the countries where the number of anti-Semitic incidents over the last year or two has decreased, because they're really the exceptions to the rule.
Right.
There's an awful lot of countries and an awful lot of communities in North America where the number of such incidents has sadly increased. But I just read an article that in Ukraine, the number of violent anti-Semitic incidents over the past year has gone down by 28%.
Yeah, that's wild. That's such a counterintuitive.
We'll come back to that in just a second. But other countries where the number of violent or even nonviolent, but spray painting graffiti of Jews go home or swastikas or whatever.
Or tombstones desecrated.
Desecrating graveyards, whatever.
Standard.
Maybe are not violent incidents of anti-Semitism, but they're certainly scary because they awaken bad memories in the collective minds of the Jewish people. So two other countries where incidents have gone down are Morocco and Tunisia. And one might be surprised. Those are Arab countries in North Africa. Both have ancient Jewish communities that have diminished to the point of not quite nothing, but a mere shadow of their former selves, literally. And I will say that in Morocco, the king, who has traditionally been a patron of the Jews almost throughout Moroccan history, and certainly over the past century or two, has devoted a large amount of his personal fortune to restoring Jewish sites and monuments and bringing them into the mainstream consciousness of Moroccan young people. Like, schools go to visit these synagogues and graveyards now that they're cleaned up a little bit. And it involves a vast amount of money, but it involves somebody in authority, and the king of Morocco is revered by his people, saying, these people are part of our history. They're a plus, not a minus. We should, what the French say, valoriser. We should value their sites, and we should spend our money. There was also this great ancient synagogue in Egypt that was just restored at huge expense to the government. Egypt is a place with very few Jews left. But in Tunisia, the minister of tourism is a Jew. And there hasn't been an incident of violent anti-Semitism in quite a while, in part because the government says, these people are part of our past, present, and our future. Treat them as such. And sometimes strong language followed up by consistent actions on the part of the government can be a dissuasion both for the sentiments and for the incidents.
It's a great point. And, it's certainly not true that everything comes from the top, but something does. And that message is an important one, a powerful one. Thanks, Tom. We will continue to explore this next week.
I look forward to it.
I promised I wouldn't start this feature on Too Jewish until there were actual elections and delegates appointed in the race to become the next president of the United States. But after some vivid Jewish moments last week in the presidential primary season, I think the time has indeed come. And so we reveal for the very first time our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective segment. Two top candidates actively sparring for the Democratic nomination for president are both Jews, with both New York and New England connections. Both have changed political parties more than once, and both are almost exactly the same age, born just 5 months apart. One is 77 years old, the other 78. But there the similarities more or less end. Bernie Sanders grew up in Brooklyn. Just listen to him speak, and you know that. And he was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. He has been a U.S. senator from Vermont for 13 years after spending 16 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. Michael Bloomberg was the three-term mayor of New York City and a spectacularly successful financial services entrepreneur. He is worth an estimated $60 billion, is the ninth wealthiest person in America and the 14th wealthiest person in the world. Sanders is one of the frontrunners in the polls for the Democratic nomination, while Bloomberg, who is paying for his own campaign out of his own pocket, is surging in the polls now. Last week, Bloomberg told a campaign event at a synagogue in Miami, "I'm not the only Jewish candidate running for president, but I am the only one who doesn't want to turn America into a kibbutz." A reference to Bernie Sanders' socialist outlook on economics and the inequitable distribution of wealth in the U.S. Look, so far, no votes have been cast and no one has any delegates, so it's really just a kind of popularity poll. And if you recall the presidential election of 2016, not one of the highly paid and highly publicized pollsters predicted the final result correctly, but just for fun. It's fascinating to note that the two Jewish candidates currently sit second and fourth among all Democratic contenders. And in some polls, Bernie is closing in on frontrunner Joe Biden, while Michael Bloomberg has come from nowhere to climb past everyone except Elizabeth Warren, Biden, and Sanders. And Bloomberg has a $5 million advertising spot, well, maybe it's $10 million, What does he care? Coming up today during the Super Bowl. Just for the record, Bloomberg belongs to Temple Emmanuel in New York City. Sanders does not belong to a shul. Just saying. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our shlicha, our representative on Israel, our mivina, our expert on Israel, Inbal Shtivi, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker tov, Inbal.
Boker ol.
So we're approaching the holiday of Tu B'Shvat, which is the great Jewish New Year for trees, but it's always an environmental festival for Jews in which we remember our deep connection through God to nature and to the world around us. And Israel has gone through a number of different phases in terms of its relationship to nature. When the state was being developed and then founded, it was draining the swamps and irrigating farmland and planting trees and recovering the land. Then it became, let's reflood the swamps so the birds have some place to land. And I think of recent generations, it's become a much greater focus on cleaning up things, on creating a connection to the natural world that God gave us. But it's not a political issue in Israel.
No, it's not. Looking at when you look at other states, even and what's on their agendas, you see that those issues of environmental conservation and generally the relation between humans and the land and the earth are taking a lot more space in political parties outside Israel. Let's say Europe,
the green parties
all over Europe, and they are leading. They're not minor or
significant parties.
They are in Israel. The Green Party's barely making it to parliament all the time.
Maybe one or two seats,
which is not enough. We need 3.25 to get into Knesset.
Right.
But so the Green Party is never part of, doesn't have like a real power. But the more interesting thing is, for me at least, is that the Green movement is all over Israel. The environmental conservation movement is active and alive by the people. There are so many organizations. Almost in every part of the country, you will see groups of citizens looking after their own premises, kind of how to clean a water stream or how to protect from pollution or things like that. That's on a local level. But on a national level, there are many organizations that are working on it. They even have a real infrastructure to support their efforts. And the issues go from water conservation and cleanup to sustainable methodologies of urban development to the anti-desertification or countering the effects of desertification.
Because of global warming, the increased spread of deserts where there used to be more fertile areas. Maybe one of the most famous of those places, the Arava Institute. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it has been there for a while. The Arava Institute is working on educating and researching on environmental issues for a few decades already, and they even have a an educational system or an educational program where they invite people from Jordan, the Palestinian Authority, and other places, and actually all over the world, to learn about the challenges of this climate era, this era of climate change, and they send back. They send them back educated, and
then they can work. In they their can own work on. Because,
yeah,
you know, it's no country is an island anymore, especially in the Middle East.
Water definitely.
And all the rest of it is all
especially,
deeply integrated.
Especially in the Middle East, where the desert is growing and growing, and our neighboring countries, Egypt, Jordan, they don't have too much water to live off. It is
fascinating time and complicated. Thank you so much, Inbal. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Too two men of Chelm went out for a walk when suddenly it started to rain. Quick, said one, open your umbrella. It won't help, said his friend. My umbrella is full of holes. Then why did you bring it? His friend asked. I didn't think it would rain. That was the old Jewish joke, the week special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and bring an umbrella. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy, Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Here representing the Weintraub Israel Center, but really representing young Israel. So you guys grew up in good areas, right? Nice parts, not out in the periphery. There's a big divide in American society between right and left. People grow up in certain areas and other areas. There's some of that same divide in Israel, right? But how was that affecting you? Did you know people very different politically from you, very different ethnically from you? When does that change?
So I think, for example, in my school, a lot of politicians came before the elections and gave their speeches. And then in our classes, we argued about that. And there were like some left-wingers, right-wingers. And we still were friends then. We're still friends, but...
So, as you said, it's passionate, but...
It's passionate, but...
But that's not what you're
right,
going to choose
we're not
your
really
over.
Divided.
Right.
I think the bigger challenge will be throughout the army and the military and after that, because then, both of us, other people are being exposed to the people right now or since they got born, but... we will be exposed to different people from different areas.
Because in every unit in the Israeli army, the idea is you have people from the fanciest neighborhoods and the worst
and
neighborhoods,
the
just based on capability
South
and talent.
Or north,
talent.
Yeah, right.
So in the best units, that's true. And in the units that are not so exclusive, it's also true. Right.
Yes. So you can find like different people all around.
Danielle, did you have much exposure to people from really different backgrounds growing up?
Not really. I was born in Emek Yisrael. I was raised in Emek Yisrael, and something they say about this
area... The Jezreel area, Valley, right?
The Jezreel Valley, yeah. They say it's very a bubble. I mean, by the time... For us, for example, Shai lives in Ramat Gan, 20 minutes from Haifa. For us, going to Tel Aviv is like almost like going outside of the country.
It's a different world.
Exactly. It's something, like, something really special for us. And they say about my area that it's like living in a bubble because you really don't get exposed to the, let's say, ugly stuff. We're just very protected. We know just like whoever we grew up with. We don't get to extreme opinions about anything. It's just the way it just is. And then going outside to Tel Aviv, for example, is like getting exposed to the real world because it's something we just don't get.
As though Tel Aviv was the real world.
Exactly. Exactly. Like that.
And the difference, I think, for American teens is... There's no general democratizing institution in the United States anymore. Everybody doesn't go in the military and serve in units with people from all over the country. In Israel, you do.
Right.
And so for you guys, you haven't had that experience yet, right?
Yeah.
It's something you're going to...
We're still children compared to the army. But in the army, you actually get exposed to everything you weren't until this point. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. It's definitely a different take. And you'll be outside your bubble.
Yeah.
Of course.
Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. Journeys are centrally important in Judaism. The act of leaving and heading out into the great unknown is crucial for us. At some level, the proper theme song for Jews might be On the Road Again. Repeatedly, great Jewish leaders, or even the whole of our people, head out into the wilderness to seek God and make a new life somewhere else. It happens first with Abraham in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha. It happens two generations later with Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel as he becomes the founder of our people. It happens again with Moses, who flees his country of birth in Egypt to find God in the Sinai Desert, leaves there to go back to Egypt, and finally... takes the whole people of Israel out of slavery, and in this week's portion of B'Shalach, puts them on the path of redemption and freedom. And it keeps happening throughout Jewish history. The idea of the wandering Jew has ideological relevance as well as pathos. Wandering seems to be something we need to do, not just something we are forced to do. In particular, Jewish religious tradition has a peculiar perspective on the events of the Exodus, which reach a climax in this week's Torah portion of B'Shalach. The great drama of Jewish history really begins with the Exodus from Egypt, the escape from Pharaoh on the shores of the Sea of Reeds, and it's logical we should focus on that. But in our prayers, practices, and traditions, we raise up this liberation from slavery and journeying out into the Sinai wilderness to the highest conceivable historical status, even beyond what seems appropriate. It's not just that we make Passover such a central holiday. The preeminent festival of freedom should be focally important, but we remind ourselves of the Exodus far more often than once a year. Every Friday night when we say Kiddush, we declare that we observe the Sabbath Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, in remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt, which isn't really true. According to our own Torah, the Shabbat goes back to God's creation of the world long before the Exodus. In every evening and morning service, we chant Micha Mocha, a direct quotation from this week's Song of Moses in B'Shalach, reminding ourselves yet again, thrice daily, that we were slaves and were freed to head out into the wilderness. We focus on this great narrative and its denouement in nearly obsessive ways. Why? Perhaps it's because our central Jewish story is about transition, travel, hitting the road. It is the core narrative of Judaism. To paraphrase Descartes, we left, therefore we are. Our essential nature as a people was formed by this exodus. Whenever we find ourselves in slavery, either physical, psychological, or moral, we must, as Jews, choose to leave. And seeing the way our ancestors did it, against all odds, in order to ultimately find a new life of ethical freedom and covenant with God, can inspire us today. When we return, our guest, Greg Schneider, Executive Director of the Claims Conference, will explore just how little people, and especially young people in France, really know about the Shoah, the Holocaust, and what is likely to be done about it. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Trump administration revealed its long-delayed plan for peace between Israel and the Palestinians, calling it the deal of the century. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu joined Trump at a news conference in Washington, D.C., and Netanyahu modestly compared this moment to President Harry Truman's recognition of the State of Israel in 1948. Netanyahu also slipped in the fact that as part of the plan's starting framework, he will try to apply Israeli sovereignty over territory that the international community considers occupied. The plan's key points may not matter so much because Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas essentially declared it dead on arrival, asserting he had 1,000 no's to the plan. Still, while it seems incredibly unlikely that this plan will result in any long-term territorial or other solution to the Palestinian problem, there were many interesting aspects to it, some quite innovative. For the first time, a peace proposal between Israel and the Palestinians actually included a genuine map showing areas Israel would cede to the new Palestinian state, approximately 70% of the West Bank. Of course, in Trump's plan, Israel would maintain full security control over both the West Bank and Gaza, which looks less like a two-state solution and more like a continuation of the current situation in perpetuity. Just as unrealistically, the plan calls for both Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the two groups with actual power in Gaza, to be dismantled. They may object to this, especially since Hamas is the democratically elected government of Gaza, while Fatah, Mahmoud Abbas's party, has not held an election in, well over a decade. More positively, the plan posits a high-speed rail tunnel connecting Gaza and the West Bank, allowing Palestinians to reunite with their families. and it assumes an actual Palestinian state of some kind, sans independent control of its own borders or military. The plan also gives all the Israeli settlements currently in existence in the West Bank to Israel as permanent possessions, as well as the entirety of the Jordan River Valley. It does require a freeze on any new settlements, just about the only part of the plan Israelis could possibly object to. Netanyahu, of course, loves the plan, but supposedly Benny Gantz, his rival from Kahol Lavan, the Blue-White Party, also has endorsed it wholeheartedly, at least according to Donald Trump. Israeli Defense Minister Naftali Bennett, however, has announced his opposition to it, saying he will never agree to a Palestinian state, while left-wing groups in Israel oppose the plan as a form of permanent apartheid for Arabs in Palestine. Not to mention, sane human beings object to the population transfer the plan suggests, which would send thousands and thousands of Israeli Arabs from the north of Israel across the border into a new Palestinian state in which they have never lived. Anyway, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most likely to actually succeed and 1 being the least, I would give this new Trump peace plan a 0. Absolutely no chance of succeeding in building a durable peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The Palestinians not only won't accept it, there is really no reason they should, including its requirement that the toothless Palestinian Authority somehow is supposed to disable and dissolve Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which in Gaza are both far stronger than Fatah. On the other hand, there's a tiny chance that even this one-sided plan might get Abbas and Netanyahu actually talking. I mean, I don't think so, but stranger things have happened, like Trump being elected and Israel being in the position of about to hold its third national election in a year without having a permanent government. Well, we shall see. In other news, Nama Issachar, a young Israeli arrested in Russia on trumped-up charges last spring and sentenced to 7 years in prison for drug possession in a highly problematic and well-publicized case. Nama Issachar was pardoned last week by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. The move came in advance of a visit to Moscow by Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Israeli media reports say the Israeli government was willing to relinquish ownership of a parcel in Jerusalem that is symbolic to the Russian Orthodox Church as a goodwill gesture ahead of Issachar's release. Ownership of the Alexander Courtyard, which lies in Jerusalem's Old City near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, has been disputed for decades, but an Israeli court recently ruled in one part of Russia's favor. I'll explain. Nama Issachar, who is 27, was returning from a trip to India and was in transit through Russia. That is, she wasn't even stopping there. The flight just stopped there. When she was detained last April, 9.5 grams, a relatively tiny amount of marijuana, was found in her checked luggage. She was subsequently convicted of drug smuggling and sentenced by a Russian court to 7.5 years in prison. Since her arrest, Bibi Netanyahu has repeatedly pleaded Nama Issachar's case with Putin, asking the Russian president, to pardon her and allow her to return to Israel. Her case gained widespread attention in Israel. Local media accused Moscow of using it to pressure Israel over a jailed Russian hacker, whose extradition was requested by both the U.S. and Russian governments. The hacker, Alexei Burkov, was extradited to the U.S. in November, taking that out of the equation. It appears that Issachar's freedom was instead garnered through appeasing the Russian Orthodox Church with this controversial courtyard in the Old City. It had been in a legal dispute between two Russian religious entities anyway. So, finally, Nama Issachar is coming home to Israel, which is good news. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Greg Schneider, is head of the Claims Conference, which has worked to establish both financial justice and educational success in explaining the Holocaust all around the world over many years. We started speaking earlier in the show about this recent survey of Holocaust knowledge in France. Is it generational? Do older French people know more about the Shoah? Do younger people know less? How is that explored?
Yes, absolutely. So there were a number of indicators that younger people, which are defined as millennials and Gen Z, right? So we're talking about the younger generation, know far less than older generations. Now, of course, that makes sense, but some of the results were actually pretty staggering. So, for instance, when we looked at, we asked the question of whether people knew that 6 million Jews were killed. Now, in the Jewish community, the number 6 million is, so commonplace, so well understood. If someone said, in the context of a synagogue, if someone says 6 million, you immediately know what you're talking about.
Of course.
It turns out that for all French respondents, 57% did not know that 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. And in fact, 30% of all French respondents believe that 2 million or fewer Jews were killed. But when you go to millennials and Gen Z, the number who didn't know, the percentage of people who didn't know that it was 6 million is 69%.
Wow.
And it was 44% who believed that fewer than 2 million were killed.
Where does this kind of lack of information come from, and where do the misperceptions come from?
I think you know what you're exposed to. So again, most people in France, particularly younger generation, we have some data that supports this, first learn about and substantially learn about the Holocaust in school. So it's really what's being taught. And of course this makes sense that an older generation, certainly older people, experienced it. They were there. They were still alive. But even kind of a middle-aged generation, so their parents, and so, you know, they were told and they kind of remembered. But as the years go on, go from generation to generation, you don't learn about it firsthand. You learn about it in school. The problem is, if this trend continues generation to generation, we're losing information, we're losing data, we're losing comprehension of really what happened, the facts, but also the significance. And so what we're trying to do, I think this survey, which was one of four that we've done, we did one in the U.S., Canada, Austria, and now France, is a wake-up call. It's a time to say, look what's happening. Our schools are not doing an adequate job, and we've got to stop the deterioration, you know, the lack of knowledge is getting worse each year. But it's really rooted in the school system.
When, there must be a variety of curricula that can be used to teach, to do a Holocaust education in France. There certainly are many that are available in English. How do they go about making those decisions, and how does one go about changing things?
So I think, like any school system you can imagine in France, it's just an issue of priorities. Teachers have to, although it's mandated across the entire country, that Holocaust education must be taught, it's compulsory. Exactly what materials, how it's done, how much time is given in the classroom is up to the teacher in particular school districts. So that's a challenge because there is a competition for time, right? There's a lot to teach, and teachers always have to decide. Now, if you're uncomfortable with a topic, if it's difficult, if you don't have the right tools, or, you know, you don't feel that you're skilled in that particular area, you're more likely to shy away from it, to not focus on it. So in the context of World War II, to spend 1 hour to talking about the Holocaust is just not sufficient. What we'd really like to see is more resources put in to teacher training so that teachers feel comfortable with the topic, are able to handle it, and have the tools and the resources. You know, one of the things that's come up a lot in France, not with our survey, but just in general, is sort of pushback from students who say, oh, no, we shouldn't learn about the Holocaust because, you know, this is something that happened to the Jews, but look how the Jews have now become, from victim, they become the perpetrators. Look what they're doing in Gaza. And, you know, if you support human rights, you really shouldn't learn about this. So, you know, this is obviously a distortion of history and of the facts, but teachers need to be equipped to deal with it. To say, well, there's pushback from the students, and therefore we can't teach it, that's not good enough. That doesn't address the issue. But to leave teachers on their own to not know how to handle that is also not acceptable. So we really see teacher training as one of the keys to understanding.
How important are Holocaust museums? I mean, they've sprung up all over the United States. I've been to the Holocaust Memorial in Paris. It's moving. It's not a museum. Is that an area that could further develop?
Yeah, so there actually is a very large, I mean, for not compared to Yad Vashem or the museum in Washington, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, but there is the Mémorial de la Shoah in Paris, right, which is a significant museum and place for reflection and archives and research center. And they do, for their size, they do a lot of teacher training, and not only teachers in France, but across Europe. So it's a model. It's an excellent model. The Claims Conference, you know, most of the funding from the Claims Conference goes directly to Holocaust survivors, either for pensions or, you know, one-time payments, or for welfare programs, home care, food, and medicine. But a small amount is spent on Holocaust education. So we are supporters of that museum and their programs. So, for instance, one of the innovative, interesting things that they've done is create sort of a mobile museum. They create an exhibit and basically put it on a truck and take it outside of Paris, in the suburbs or into other cities, and invite people to come or make connections with schools and bring them to come. So it's a little bit complicated in some areas because you have a very large immigrant population. So if you have a lot of Syrian refugees, for instance, in a particular area, this is a topic that's totally new to them. And how are they going to react to that? How are they going to handle that? But doing those sort of innovative programs, you go outside of a sort of center intellectual elite Paris and into, you know, real France, meet real people, that's how we're going to make a difference.
Do you work with anybody? I mean, do you have the capacity to work with anybody in the French establishment to create more elaborate curricula in French?
So probably, I can't remember now, but I think about two decades ago, there was a settlement with the French government that related to heirless property that had been confiscated and had to be returned, but there was no heir to give it to. And based on that, there was money that was set aside. An organization created in France, in English it would be the Foundation for the Memory of the Holocaust And so there's an organization, there's a body in France that works on this and does a lot of work on curriculum development, teacher training, films in French, lots of material. So I think the problem, if I had to identify a problem, it would not be the dearth of curriculum, the dearth of materials, and particularly in French. That's not the issue. The issue is ensuring that it's being used.
In working with, have you experienced so far any resistance besides, teachers don't want to do it, they're already put upon too much, that kind of stuff, which is pretty normal anytime you want to introduce any program or further any program. Have you received any real resistance in France?
So there are certainly anecdotes about classrooms in which the students sort of revolt. I don't mean physically, but say, listen, we don't want to learn about the Holocaust, or we shouldn't take up this topic, or, you know, this is wrong because, yeah, this is the Jews kind of were victims there, but then they turn around to become perpetrators in Palestine, they would say. Sort of that sort of pushback. Or maybe, listen, there were lots of genocides, and it has happened since 1945, so why are we learning about this one in particular? Again, giving teachers the tools to explain what was unique about the Holocaust, what was the experience, what was the Jewish experience, or what is the Jewish component to this, and why that was so important to the Jewish people, and then the wider lessons of that. How do you take that and understand what that means, looking at, I guess, simultaneously at what the unique factors of the Holocaust, what makes it unique, and the universal lessons that can be drawn from that. But again, the key is giving the teachers the tools to be able to handle anything that comes up in the classroom.
I want to thank Greg Schneider of the Claims Conference for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about this recent survey and about the Claims Conference in general?
So the best place is on our website, which is ClaimsCon, ClaimsCon.org, ClaimsCon.org. We have an executive summary so that in about 15 pages you could read all the details, you get all the data about the survey, and understand the greater issues or sort of the context in which the survey was done.
Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Sarah Abravaya Stein, the multinational Jewish Book Award-winning author of a new book, Family Papers, A Sephardic Journey Through the 20th Century. Our playout this morning comes from Gad Elbaz and Benny Elbaz, God's hit song Hashem Melech, based on the hymn God Rules, God Ruled, God Will Always Rule. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace. And enjoy watching your slightly Jewish Super Bowl today.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.